during my first two interviews, self-interviews or autobiographical narratives, I talked about where things are at with me right now, from the point of view of beginning at the end, because the end is the beginning. That's where we start from. I'm starting this recording, this moment, from the place in my life where I'm at now. But all things are historical. All things go through a process of development to get to the point where they are at any given moment. So if you take a snapshot of a flower blooming, that's just a moment in time. That doesn't give any indication of the process of development. And so, you know, we all understand that flowers come from some kind of bulb or seed or something that grows up out of the ground, and it's usually dormant during the winter, and then it grows up some green leaves and a stalk, and then it has flowers, and then the flowers die, and often there are seeds produced, and those seeds go back into the ground and go through that whole process of death and rebirth that is, you know, a constant cycle. Some plants are perennial, some are annuals, and, you know, most of us know these things just from our own personal experience. But when you look at somebody's life, or you look at something like, let's say you look at the Blue Ridge Mountains, you only get to see, at least at first glance, where things are at a certain moment in time. And even then, you don't see real deeply unless you study something deeply. And so the initial information and knowledge that we develop is superficial and non-historical. It's very limited. So, since I've done two autobiographical sketches on where I'm at now, particularly politically, some personally, I think maybe the place to go from here is to talk about my development, my history, how the path that I followed, the road that I took to get to be where I am today. And within this, I think there's a certain basic lesson that I've come to believe. And that is a philosophical lesson, which is that freedom is the appreciation of necessity. So what I mean by that is simply that there are some things that we really don't have any choice about. For instance, I had no choice about being adopted. I had no choice about being white or male. I really didn't have any choice about where I grew up, at least while I was very young and had very little control over my life. Later, I made choices. That was my freedom. I mean, I'm sure I started making choices from day one, but choosing things like where to live came later in life. But that was my freedom. I could make the choices that I wanted to within certain limits of necessity, or at least things that felt like necessity, like, you know, what money I had, or what kind of how old I was, you know, various things like that, what responsibilities I had. But in particular, I just had more freedom as I developed as a human being. And of course, I grew up in a society where I was one of the privileged people and had relatively lots of resources and so forth. So I actually felt pretty much like I could do what I wanted and go where I wanted to and be whatever I wanted to be. That's certainly not true for many, many people. I mean, look at slavery. Obviously, people did not have those same kinds of measures of privilege and freedom. But even in slavery, people had freedom. I mean, if you were put in chains and brought over on a slave ship, you had choices that you could make all along the way. And once you became a slave in the southern United States or New York or Brazil or wherever, you had choices. Some of them weren't very good choices. They might have been choices between many undesirable things, like you could run away from slavery. You could try to escape and establish your freedom someplace else. You could resist slavery. You could submit to slavery. The choices, you know, were framed by necessity. I mean, you had to deal with the fact that the slave society was violent and repressive. That was a necessity. You didn't have any choices about that. But within that framework of necessity, you could appreciate what possibilities there were for freedom. I could look at the situation and I could say, well, you know, I can sneak away during the night and see my wife on this other plantation, and I know how to evade the slave patrols, and so on and so forth. Well, the slave patrols were necessity, but my freedom was in my appreciation, my understanding of the whole situation and what choices I did have. So in any case, I grew up with choices, and like all of us, and I didn't have choices about certain things, but within that framework of necessity, particularly the more I understood it and how it worked, and what the limits were and what the possibilities were, I could develop my own framework of freedom, my own ways of being free and developing in the way that I chose. So just to put it in a very simplistic and short way, I grew up a very privileged white male, fairly affluent, got a really good education, had lots of opportunities, and Protestant background, family connections, etc., etc. So, you know, from a material point of view, that was who I was. I mean, someone would look at me from afar. They'd take a snapshot of me, or get to know me superficially, or just look at me. And they could tell by the way I talked, by the way I looked, a good deal about how I had been raised and who I was, in a sense, in a very limited, superficial, static sense. But we all forge our own identities. And that process is full of contradictions. For instance, in my case, both society at large and my family tried very hard to shape my identity, and no doubt succeeded in many ways. But as it turned out, I was a rebellious person, and I chose not to accept many of the things that society and my family prescribed for me. So as I grew older, I forged an identity that was what we might call counter-hegemonic. It was the identity of a class and race traitor, in a sense a gender traitor, someone who was a man who was opposed to sexism, someone who was white who was opposed to racism, someone who was affluent and privileged and elite, who tried to identify with the working people and those who were oppressed and limited and denied throughout the world. So we build our own identity within the framework of our necessity, and the more we appreciate our necessity, like I can't escape being a white male, for instance, and I know that others will judge me by that, particularly superficially. But within that necessity, I can appreciate that I have certain abilities and privileges and advantages, as well as limitations and disadvantages that enable me to do some things and other things not so well. For instance, in terms of my present, it's not easy being a white privileged male to gain the trust and confidence of black workers in the community. And I will never have the experience of those black workers or of young black people growing up in a deeply racist and exploitive society. I will never have that experience. But I can try to learn about that experience, and through solidarity with folks who are struggling for freedom from oppression and limits and so forth, I can, to some extent, learn to appreciate the necessity and the freedom that are the necessities that are imposed on black people and the freedoms that are asserted by black people. And so let me just sort of quickly, it may not be all that quick, but let me just go through my process of political development. As my friend Sally Bermanzong would say, political socialization from early childhood up to the present, and see if I can create a coherent narrative or at least give some insights. I was just as background, I was adopted when I was 11 months old. In another autobiographical sketch, I'll talk all about my adoption and my mother and my father and my birth mother and all of that. But for the time being, let's just say that I was adopted at 11 months old from a situation that was difficult. And I came from Los Angeles to Cleveland, Ohio, actually to a house. I think it was in Cleveland. No, it wasn't in Cleveland Heights. It might have been in Shaker Heights, I guess. And I was adopted by two relatively older people. My adoptive father was Ralph Eddie Chapman, who was, since I was adopted in February of 1948, he would have been about 49 years old. And my adoptive mother was Celeste Beckwith Chapman, who was a year younger than my father, and they had no children. And they lived in a pretty nice house, certainly no mansion, but a very comfortable suburban house on Seabor Road in Shaker Heights. And my earliest memories, of which I can remember very few, are from that period when I lived on Seabor Road, which I think was only for a year or two. And so one of my earliest, very earliest memories is crawling on the grass in the front yard of the Seabor Road house, which I seem to remember as having hedges around it. And there was a low sandstone table, gray sandstone, which is very common building material in that part of Ohio and comes from quarries near Cleveland, and was laid down as sand by glaciers, and you know, it can be cut very smooth and flat. And anyways, so there was this little bench in the yard that was built up with, I guess probably on each side it had three little sandstone sort of rough-shaped blocks that served as legs for the table, and then it had a fairly big sandstone slab. And what I remember, at least this is, it seems incredible that I could remember anything at this age. And, you know, maybe it's a photograph or something that I remember, but what I seem to remember is crawling and reaching this table and pulling myself up on it. Or maybe maybe just toddling to it and I remember touching the flat surface, and it was very cool and pleasant feeling. And then that's all I remember. And the next memory that I have was also on Seymour Road, and this one I'm pretty sure is real. But it was obviously just a little bit later in life when I was walking more. And my father, Ralph, took me on a little walk outside of the house. And I don't know exactly where, but not very far. And we came to a place where there was a tree, and my father said, "That's an apple tree." And there were these apples lying on the ground. Of course, I didn't know what they were. And he said, maybe I picked it up, or he said, "You can pick that up." And, maybe he cleaned it off. I remember he said, "Take a bite out of it." And I took a bite, and I remembered that sweet taste, and I remember that it was my father that opened up this whole world of discovery to me. And that's my earliest memory of my father. I actually don't have any specific memories of Celeste, my mother, at that time. It seems as though when I was maybe 3 years old or 2 years old, we moved from that house, and I have just the vaguest memory that we went to this other house that was bigger, and the person who lived there, whose house it was my grandmother. And so my father and I and Celeste went to live with my grandmother, and that was at 2937 Falmouth Road, F-A-L-M-O-U-T-H. I always abbreviated it by saying foul mouth. And that was in Shaker Heights, which was at that time the richest suburb in the United States, the wealthiest. And this was on a tree-lined street, very sort of quiet. The sidewalks were all made out of this same kind of gray, flat sandstone that little bench had been made out of. And there were sidewalks on both sides of the street and, stop signs at all the corners, which wasn't all that usual everywhere. And the houses were all sort of old. Our house was built in the early 1900s, I think around 1910, by my grandfather. My grandmother's name was Olive Crawford Beckwith, and my grandfather's name was Ansel Earl Beckwith. That house had been built, around 1910. My grandfather had died. My grandmother inherited the house as part of his estate. And so Celeste and Ralph and I moved in with my grandmother. And I had, this house also was right across the street from an elementary school, Shaker Heights Elementary, I think it might have been called. And so I had my own room. It was sort of a very nice little room. I remember it a lot. It had sort of wallpaper. Maybe they were stick-ons on the wallpaper. I can't remember, but there was animals all around my room. I mean, we had all kinds of lions and bunnies and different kinds of animals around the room, and I really liked them a lot. And there was my little dresser that I think Sandy's got now. And I had a little bed, and I think my dad may have made it. I mean, I think it had a regular bed frame, but I remember that he made the backboard out of Pecky Cypress, which is a funny kind of wood, very, very pretty looking. It's sort of a decorative wood, but it's got holes all through it from bugs. That's why it's called Pecky. And but this was very nice kind of bed. It was little. It was my size, and there was a big chair sitting next to the bed, and maybe a little table. And right behind the bed, there was the radiator. The house was heated by radiators. And every night, my mother would sit in that chair, and she'd be wearing her glasses, and she'd read to me for an hour, every single night. And that was one of my most wonderful memories of her. Our favorite book, and of course, maybe this was when I got just a little bit older, was called The Little Gray Men. And, you know, it was about these little dwarf kind of people. And, you know, they sailed down the little stream in their boats made out of leaves and stuff, and had all kinds of adventures. And then later she used to read me stories about horses. She loved horses, and in fact she had her own horse, I think, before she adopted me. And her horse was named Jackie Searle. And we had a library in that house with all this really nice dark wood paneling and built-in dark wood bookshelves, just chock full of mostly old books, like, you know, the collected works of so-and-so, you know, all these old famous authors from England, or mostly English. But also French and others. And there was a picture of my mother with her horse, Jackie Searle, when she was a much younger woman, which I was always sort of interested in, because she would tell me stories about her horse and riding and showing her horse, I think. So she read to me, and later on she read me stories like Black Beauty and Born to Trot and things like that. And then we also, when I was a little bit older, got into, we never got into Dick Tracy, but we got into some other series of books, that were about a kid and science. I can't think of it right now, but those were some really good sort of adventure, Dick Tracy type, sort of Hardy Boys type books, actually. But they were about this young boy and his friends who were into sort of science kind of stuff, you know, discovering caves and whatever. I don't remember, but I hope maybe I can recover that memory at some point. So I grew up in this very privileged environment, and my friends in the neighborhood, my best friend across the street was Charlie Hudson, and his father was the head of the American Medical Association. And the Leibs lived next door to us. And they had two daughters, one about my age, Aunt Kathy, and I forget her older sister's name. And they were Jewish. There was a number of, sort of, right across the street was a Jewish family, and next door was a Jewish family, and there were a number of Jewish families on the street, and I knew that they were Jewish because my mother talked about them as being Jewish, and we weren't as close friends with them as we were with some of the other non-Jewish people on the street. Johnny Verdon lived in a house right next to the elementary school. Del Marting lived down the street a little ways, and he ended up being a star football player at Yale, and I watched him play in the Harvard-Yale game. And then there were some others. And the next door neighbors were the Rayburns, and they had two boys. Andy was the younger one, who I wasn't much friends with, and Jimmy was my age or maybe a year younger, and we spent an awful lot of time playing together. He was he wasn't a particular popular kid at school. He was a little gawky, but we had a good friendship, I thought, although I really, and I'll get into this at some point, I was sort of the controlling partner in the friendship. And his father really took me under his wing, because my father, you know, was getting into his 50s, and he wore trifocal lenses, and he couldn't really do anything athletic. I tried to play softball catch with him in the backyard, and he did okay, but he had a really hard time following the ball as it rose and fell because of the trifocal glasses. It would go through three different prisms of his glasses, and what he was able to do with me in terms of sports and even his interest in sports was quite limited, and I ended up being just a, you know, pretty much of an athlete. And Jimmy Rayburn's father would take me to Cleveland Browns football games and Cleveland Indians baseball games, and I ended up being a pitcher starting in junior high school in baseball, and he would be my catcher, and I'd practice with him. And he was a very friendly guy. Me and Jimmy and him and probably some other people, you know, maybe Andy, I can't remember. We played endless games of ping pong in their basement. And, you know, just various kinds of things. And, of course, I would go, when I got a little bit older, I would go across the street to the schoolyard. And I was real close to the house, so it was quite safe. And I would go over there and play. You know, after school was over, all of us boys would just hang out. All the boys in the neighborhood would hang out, and we'd have these pickup softball games or pickup touch football games or pickup basketball games. And I was always right in the middle of all of that. And then when my mother wanted me to come home for dinner, she had this bell, you know, it was sort of, I've got it someplace here, and it was this sort of brass bell, and she could ring it, and I would hear it, and I would know that meant it was time to come home. So, how to keep this focused, let's see. The other thing was that we had a summer cottage that we went to. And we always called it Madison, which was actually the name of the community. But this cottage was part of the Madison Gulf Lakelands, which was a resort community in a sense, a summer place where people from not only Ohio but New York and Connecticut and different places would come and spend the summer in their second houses, you know, and it was right near the beach on Lake Erie. And so I could walk in about 10 minutes from my house down to the private beach that we had, which was part of the country club. And I spent hours upon hours hanging out there with my mother. My dad didn't ever go. But my mother would take me to the beach, and, you know, I'd stay in the water forever. And she didn't ever come in the water, so she had a hard time getting me out. But she would, unlike most of the women there who were soaking up huge amounts of sun and getting totally brown and wrinkled, and putting oil all over themselves and in their swimsuits, my mother would be there all covered up with, you know, shorts and a blouse and something covering her legs and a hat and a beach umbrella. And she would read her books or do her crocheting or whatever. And so the summers I had a great time, you know, going to the beach. But I actually developed a friendship with a local boy named Mike Jackson, who lived, you know, the whole area was not really all that built up. So we had our cottage, and there were several lots that we owned. And right next to the cottage, which was actually a four-bedroom house with a small dining area and a fairly decent-sized living room with a fireplace and a little tiny kitchen, and, you know, with an old gas stove and stuff. And my grandmother had her separate bedroom, and my dad had his separate bedroom, and my mother had her separate bedroom, and I had my little bedroom. And you know, I just loved that house. It was totally informal compared to my house in Cleveland. In Cleveland, everything was oriental rugs and fancy old furniture, and you had to be careful of everything. And at Madison, we had wicker furniture and floors that were painted, you know, without rugs, not many anyways, and just very simple colors and sort of pastels, and it was smaller, and, you know, it was just great. Anyways, I developed this friendship with Michael Jackson, who lived, there was a wooded lot between our house and the Jacksons. And I don't know much about the Jacksons. I can't even remember how I met Mike. But, you know, it was like junior high school or younger, possibly. Yeah, it was younger. And he was just a boy my age and very adventurous, like I was. We'd go out in the woods and do stuff all the time, and we'd make up these games. Actually, I would make up most of the games, as I remember. But he'd come down to my house a lot, and we'd play Pirates in the Woods, and we'd go beating our way through the woods with sticks. And, we had all kinds of things. We did little sports contests, you know, long jump and races. We'd play badminton. We'd try to go discovering stuff in the woods. We'd play ball. I don't remember. We just had a great time. And he was my best friend in the summer. And I used to go up to their house every once in a while. Not too often, more as I got older. And they were really a different kind of people than I was used to. They lived in this fairly good size, but very simple house compared to what I was used to in Shaker Heights. And I didn't actually get inside very much, just in the kitchen sometimes. And they had these two huge oak trees out front, and a big garden, about a quarter of an acre garden. And he had a sister, I believe, a younger sister, maybe an older sister too. And, you know, they all ran around without shoes and just in these sort of little plain dresses and stuff. And, of course, I had no understanding of class or anything like that at this point in my life. And I really didn't know much about the family. I think I learned later that the father was a police officer in Madison. So they were the locals. And the locals and the summer people didn't mix all that much. So this friendship of mine might have been a little bit unusual, but we had a great time. And then when I got to be about 12 years old, I had been spending more time up there at Mike Jackson's house. And I remember walking back down the little road that we had, Selkirk Avenue, I think it was, or possibly, yeah, Selkirk was the road we lived on, and then Trinity Lane, Trinity came up from the beach. So I was walking down Selkirk to my house, and the roads weren't really paved. They were just gravel and dirt, but they would spread oil on them, and that sort of paved them until the chunks of tarry oil would break up, and then they'd have to re-oil them. But those are the kind of roads that we had out there, and we had a gravel driveway and all that kind of stuff, lots of woods around us. Nothing like Shaker Heights. And so I remember walking down, I was walking down the road to my mother's house, and I hear Joyce calling me in the background, so I'm going to stop in just a second, but I'll finish this one story. And I remember talking to my mother in the yard, and she told me that I couldn't go up to Mike Jackson's house anymore. He could come to visit me, but I wasn't allowed to go up there. And this was just horrible news for me. It was like, why? What was this all about? And she said, well, you know, they're just not our kind of people. And I can't remember what else she said about that, but she might have said something about them being Catholic or something, not having the same kind of cultural values or whatever. And so that actually ended our relationship, my relationship with Mike Jackson. He may have come down to the house some, but I don't remember what happened. If I told him that, I don't know what he would have thought. But for years, we didn't really see each other or talk to each other and I felt really guilty about it, like I had abandoned him and betrayed him. And I was very resentful of my mother. And later, as I developed and started understanding more about the world, I realized that this was my mother's class and religious prejudice coming out. I was getting to that age. In the South, this was the same age where black and white kids who had been allowed to play together and mix and do everything together when they were little. But when the kids started reaching puberty, they were generally separated and not allowed to interact in the same ways. And so, you know, as I was starting to reach puberty, I think my mother was concerned that I might get involved with his sisters, or that the cultural influence was bad, or that they were Catholic, and she had a real thing about Catholics, which I'll get into later. And so she just wouldn't let me see them. And this was the beginning of my class development.